Send one over, and this is Debbie's side and her response to Cookie this Wednesday at supper and after the Wednesday night, the 11th of August, 1971. Send one over. This is Debbie's side, her response to Cookie this Wednesday night at supper and after the 11th of August, 1971.
Get a word
from it's been a long time just with Debbie in town and even out here
to get a word
to get a word and find out what in the world she's been up to and all like that.
It's taken a long time. Well, I quit my job in Boston,
yeah.
And I am going to go work. Do you remember Phoebe Flory? Yeah. I'm going to work for her this fall.
Very well.
And what? Well, we're going to. She's trying to write some art education slide tapes, and she's hired me to help her write the script this fall.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do that, and maybe I don't know whether it'll work out or not, but maybe we're going to travel next winter after Christmas. She wants to teach somewhere abroad. And she apparently just heard from the State Department saying that, you know, they'd help her arrange something. So, we'll see. I might end up in Europe yet in January.
Yeah.
Which would please me a lot.
Working.
Yeah, working. Teaching art. I had my first art lesson this summer. Actually, Phoebe gave us lessons when we were younger. She gave us watercolor lessons. And she gave us, you know, palettes, little paint boxes and everything. I don't know where they are. I came home and asked Mother where they were, and she said, I don't know. They're lost in our house. I don't know where they are. And I'd love to get it because I want to paint when I go back. She was teaching this summer, and I was up for about 10 days after I quit my job, and I went to two of her classes. So I'd love to paint this fall, too. Not that I can paint anything good, but I did paint something that looked like a tree. You know, you get pretty excited when you put the paint on and it comes out looking like a tree.
Yes, I would, sure.
It was a pretty dark tree. Everybody else in the class had these, you know, beautiful light. It was a sunny, sunny day, really bright, and everybody had the sun in their trees. Well, my tree had a little too much blue in it. It looked dark. But I'd like to paint, I think. It would be fun.
Well, especially with Phoebe.
Mm-hmm.
To help.
Yeah.
She's right lively, isn't she?
Boy, she's a very energetic person. She really is. She does a lot.
I think it'd be interesting just to be around her. She'd see so much that I wouldn't see.
Just it's amazing just to ride in a car with her and hear her talk about, say, the colors that she's going by, because she's painted for so many years. You know, it's really an experience just to hear that, I think, just to be around a painter.
Well, she's interested in lots of things, though, isn't she?
Oh, yes. You mean in art or...
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean just in general.
She's interested in just about everything. It'll be really nice being up there. We both do yoga. I took yoga lessons this winter. And stand on my head and everything.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Bet you can't.
Can. Two bits says I can't. right. He won't build a shed.
You're right. He won't build a shed.
I just...
Debbie's got Cookie on her mind. She can't talk about herself. She's fascinated with Cookie.
You gave me such a show tonight. I just never had such a conversation with her.
He took her out to shores.
And he said, what did he say to me when we went out? He said, come see something. The monster I bought or something. And I thought he meant his Cadillac.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well,
he took you out to see this.
And showed me the deed and everything.
He is just proud of that.
Debbie came in to help me with supper, guy. And Cookie came and got her.
Yeah.
And took me back
just
out.
Came and got her.
To see that. And he's really something. And that when we were going out to the back pasture, and he was talking about going to the beach. I mean, it was just, I'm not going to the beach anymore. Too expensive. I thought he meant he had to buy too many hot dogs.
$100 in an afternoon.
Oh, dear. Isn't he funny? Oh. Well, let me see. I'll talk about me. I'm perfectly happy to talk about me. What would you like to know?
Well, you see, that's the point of it, Debbie. I gave you that little book. And Cookie does that. He lives like that.
Mm-hmm.
Every day it's just like coming back from afar, as Thoreau says, you know, in the Firewater. Now, Cookie has some incident to report everywhere he goes, anytime.
It makes no difference.
There's always something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see, he just like Mark Twain. Now, Mark Twain didn't look for those things. They just come to him. Cookie don't look for things.
He just observes them when they happen.
They just come to him. You don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. They don't do that to me.
And this flare, when he was leaving, he was going to go trading.
And then he came back in and said, remember the night I danced all night.
Night I danced all night.
So we'd be sure that to know that he was not only a good trader, but a good dancer, too. Not only could he trade all night, but he could dance all night, too.
You know, Faye remembers this. We were in the... wasn't it down at the station there, Faye? This was way back last spring, and it was one of the low points. He was trying to get out of that gas station, service station, and it didn't look like he was ever going to get out of it. And he said, people down here would never think that I'd go off trading horses.
He said, people pass this station and see me pumping gas.
Mm.
They don't know.
They wouldn't think that I ever went off and traded horses.
He phrased it the way his mind wasn't on that.
Yeah.
That he was.
Puts him up sort of like a,
yeah,
a monarch nice above pumping gas.
Yeah, but it's not really that. It's what Mark Twain did in Roughing. Comes home, there's something to talk about. And you see, for a world that's full of officers, it's shameful that gift can't go around. When they come home, what have they tell? I sold this insurance policy today. It's one of the biggest I ever sold. What in the world is it doing?
tell about?
Not much.
Good to see you. And then, and now look at all those things Cookie touched on tonight. And all those, I have picked up this, you see, from the work I do around the neighborhood. I sometimes feel if I had access to the people, and it's a little hard to have access to them. By access to them, you see, you have to get them, and I have to get them over here because there's nowhere else they can cut off. They can't at home.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't leave home. They're tied down most of the time. But I feel like if I could get some of these people over here, say once a week, and they just talk about all these things on their mind, just like Cookie talked tonight. They live in a fantastic world.
Mm-hmm. They really do.
And it's alive. Everything in it is just alive. Now you see, I'm just putting that in words. I could give you examples, you see, but you never know that. You never know what they do. What they think about.
We happen to know one of the owners of the place where Cookie worked when we first knew Cookie.
Yeah.
At Bradenton. And we know him, you know, well. And we were talking to him just one day, and Cookie's worked down there a good while. He doesn't know anything about Cookie.
Nothing.
He doesn't know except that he just comes to work. And he thinks he knows him.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of knowing whether they have enough to eat or how many children they have. That's not it.
Yeah.
But you see,
it's a matter of really talking to people.
But now, let me tell you, what you saw Cookie tonight is there's absolutely no way in which J.J. Bradenton could hear that.
Because he wouldn't hear it even when Cookie said it.
There's no place where Cookie can say it.
That's right.
He can't say it to him down there. There's no occasion for it. He could tell me down there because I know how he talks and how he can report. And if J.J. was out here, Cookie would just be polite to him.
Mm-hmm.
And there would...
So the employee.
You see, there's absolutely no way. He has no access whatsoever. So you actually got a glimpse tonight that he couldn't get. The old firm of Brazenton, Cadillac, and Pontiac, and Chrysler could not get the view of Cookie that you got tonight, could they?
Uh-uh.
No, sir.
That's a relation. They just wouldn't be coming.
And furthermore, that's a glimpse of the countryside, which no one on the university campus has. They think they're all dull and flat-headed and mercenary and got too many children.
And they just don't know.
They have no idea what people like Cookie. You see, they're the ones who do the work over there. They have absolutely no idea what they're like. They're not even conscious that they're there.
Well, now that's what I have to do this fall when I go up to New Hampshire, out to this little town where I'm going to be living. It's like Evanston. There's one store and one gas station and just a whole lot of people that live there. And in a way, it's just, you know, I equate it in my mind sort of with Evanston because the people are just pure in a different way than the people out here are. You know, they're pure old New England farmers that don't talk. You know, how do you get them to talk? They don't talk. Phoebe, there's an old woman that lives across the street from Phoebe, and when Phoebe moved in 5 years ago, she went over and thought she'd, you know, get to know her neighbors and asked. She didn't think she'd ask her to have anything alcoholic to drink, so she said, "Would you like to come for a cup of tea?" "I don't drink tea." And didn't speak to her again for 5 years. She didn't say anything until one weekend I was up there and we were in getting the mail. And this old woman came into the store and said, "Good morning." And we got outside the store and Phoebe said, "She hasn't talked to me in 5 years. I wonder what I did." Isn't that amazing? But how do you get them to talk?
When I came out here, to work with people like that. And I had one right after another I made contact with. And one right after another walked off. And
you
I
just
had
to wait.
I had absolutely no idea what it was. And the first one that I have ever been able to work with is Cookie. And I've done that through the tape. I tape it and then study it.
And then you know sort of how to talk to me.
And then the tape, you see things that you don't see at the time.
Mm-hmm. You have to be able to hear the same conversation over again, sort of.
Because
well,
you don't know what
you don't
they
know
say.
What went on.
Yeah, I had trouble a couple times following him, you know, figuring out what it was he was saying.
It's like Eric Tetwright said. He and two of the other correspondents, John Chancellor and somebody, interviewed the president one night. And on the evening news, he said he got so rattled trying to keep up with what the president was saying and trying to think up questions of his own. And when he lost track of everything that was happening, and he had to go home and listen to a tape of it to know what took place. And I think I have found, from my little experience in that, of course I don't have the experience Eric Chevrolet in, that's what happened. You talk to people, you don't know what happened. You don't know what you said. You don't know what they said.
That is if you have any focus at all in what you talk.
Yeah.
And lots of times we'll be sitting here just like tonight. Now, it sounded like little bits and pieces.
Yeah.
You listen to the tape. You'll even find it has direction.
Oh, yeah. Especially
And if you study the tape, it's absolutely unbelievable what
yeah.
comes out.
That's right.
And see, on the surface, we would have kicked Cookie out 100 times.
Yeah.
Because he's
and
a scoundrel.
We've been kicked out, you see.
Yeah. But you see, we see.
That's right.
And you see, I don't pretty this table up. Because their table's not pretty yet. He drinks coffee, so I don't offer him tea. And as far as Cookie thinks, you see, he doesn't know we've lived another life.
Uh-huh.
Well, now, that's one of their limitations. You have to stay within their experience.
Yeah.
And it's hard on them to they don't project. They
no.
will within each other's frame, but they won't get out of it. But that's one of you gotta make certain allowances.
Sure. And there's no reason why you can't try to be in as many different worlds as you can. I mean, you know,
that's the way you learn.
Sure. I mean, trying to get into his world is just fine. You know, you shouldn't. If you're going to learn about it, you don't want him to come into your world.
Well,
really, you want to get in his.
Anybody, I don't mind coming to my world. He can, if he wants to. If he can make it. But anybody you talk to, what you want to do is get a toehold. That's hard to do.
It is hard to do.
You have to know how. Where are you going to learn?
Just have to try, I guess.
But isn't it amazing that you can read Fulton or Mark Twain?
And have him
but
open
you can't look at the living.
He opens his mouth and it's just
and that's
the
it.
Same thing.
Yeah. I took a little, I don't play tapes up the office, you see. I don't want the reputation of that. But I took a little tape. Mark Twain had that Mexican plug horse. And the object of that is he was taken, you see. They beat him in the trade. And none of the chaps who read it got that out of it. They thought about him, didn't know anything about horses and things like that. I, over here, one night, Fell and Mabel, and Fell is one of those natural Mark Twains.
Oh.
Are they from a rat?
Yeah, they're the pastor.
Oh, he had a gift. He had a gift. It's just fantastic. He had traded horses. Doesn't have a saying. He's been a sawmill man and cut shingles and all just, you know, you just everything. I thought I'd try it, Mark prayed on him. I said, right here. And I read that little section, Mexican for the horse, just a page, where the auctioneer's brother come up and spoke to him.
And what did he do?
Why, his eyes flashed. And he took in every word. And just as soon as I let up, he told the case just like it. The same identical thing. I said, Phil, have you ever been cook? But these youngsters, you see, I just read a page. And it was just like that, you see. So I took that tape up. That's what I was going to tell you. I took that tape up there where Phil was talking. I read a little bit, and then Phil talked about it. And they said, it's just almost like opening the door. They said they never knew that Faulkner sounded like that. You see, all those voices in Faulkner and Mark Twain, they can't hear. It's literally one goddamn. It's sterile. Might as well read that or faster.
You've got to hear the voices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You've got to know how to hear.
And you see, Cookie brings it to life.
He does. Well, now I can't report anything as good as this.
See? It's our world we live in, Debbie.
It's awful.
It's our world we live in.
I've been working
see.
In a sterile office for 2 years.
Sterile.
Well, now, that's what I've been waiting for 2 years now, to see how you're going to bring that to life.
Oh, well, I just couldn't do it. That's why I left.
That's why she left. Debbie just wrote and said, I've had it.
I've had it with big cities. I don't want to live in a big city anymore.
Yeah. You gave it a try, then.
I gave it a try.
Yeah.
I mean, I never lived in a big city, so I think I should go and live in one. But
Whitman could live in a big city and go down and talk to the ferry. Maybe you just didn't look.
Well, I... No. Well, there are a lot of interesting people in the city. I mean, I'll admit that. I mean, there are a lot of people to talk to and everything, but they're just too many. You know, you can't very well concentrate if there's so many of them. It's pretty hard to talk to someone when you're standing like this next to them in the subway.
You don't have any occasion, do you?
Yeah, it's just, there's so many people that you really end up only seeing a few because there's so many. And you're just anonymous, sort of. I mean, Boston isn't even like New York now or someplace like that. I went to New York last summer, I guess, for a while to visit a friend, and I just was sort of shattered when I came out. I felt like I was a little aunt living in a little, you know, we stayed in her little tiny apartment, and we'd go out of this huge building onto streets where...
Now, slow up, say it. I feel like you're waiting for it to say something. See, I'm listening now.
You come out of the building after you've been in this little tiny apartment where you open the door to go in and you walk into the kitchen and put your hand out like that and touch the other side. And then you come out and you're on the street and you can't see trees. You have to look up to see the sky, look up 18 stories, you know. I don't know how people live in New York. I really don't. It's just completely beyond me how anyone could live there. I mean, Boston got to me, and Boston is a relatively, you know, easy to take big city, I think. Well, we lived in a very nice neighborhood. I mean, there were trees and dogs and, you know, grass and kids. You know, It was a suburb, really, more than just right downtown.
You get your feet on the ground?
Get your feet on the real ground. Mm-hmm. The real dirt. As a matter of fact, they tore up our road in front of our building for an entire year, so we got to get our feet in that. Somebody started, they were putting down a new surface that was supposed to not buckle and get frost heaves or something. It was an experiment. Well, they started tearing the road up in October, so they had to stop in about 4 weeks because the ground got frozen, and they couldn't do anything again until May when the ground, so all winter long, the road was torn up. They took the whole surface up and then left it all winter, which I thought was kind of poor planning. But obviously somebody politically somewhere wanted to start. Boston has got very corrupt city politics. But I was ready to get out of cities. I'm just so happy I'm going to be living in the country this fall. I don't know.
But now, the office up there didn't yield any talk like this.
Not at all. Not at all. Mm-mm. Now, all anybody ever had to talk about was, you know, the job or something. Nobody really had anything exciting to talk about. There was one woman that I worked with who had a very interesting career before she came to work with us. She had a stroke and came to work with us after that. And she had done quite a lot and, you know, had gone out to California and had started her own business and all this. But she didn't talk about it very much, you know, just every now and then I could get her to bring it up, you know, and talk about it. But she didn't want to talk about it particularly.
Well, she just didn't want to talk.
No, she was willing to talk. She just didn't want to talk about that so much. I think maybe she didn't like to, you know, maybe she didn't like to compare it to what she was doing now.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it was painful for her.
I see. Had her own business and then had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And then had to
and then
take
she
a job.
Got. Well, she was had her own public relations firm out in California, and then she was director of public relations someplace else at a hospital somewhere. And when she came to work at Tufts, she was just a file clerk. And one of the men that I worked with found out about her past, you know, and she's a very fine writer. And so he said, "This is ridiculous that she's a file clerk." And so he got her put on the faculty, so that she could get salary, you know, not she's an academic personnel instead of non-academic personnel, so she could get salary increases. And she's writing now, you know, but she can't have a job that has too much pressure because she's, you know, sort of nervous and not, she can't stand up under pressure very well. But she's a really fine person. I enjoyed her a lot. Really is. She started out as a crime reporter for a newspaper in Maine. She did all the crime reporting for about 5 years, which
like
I think is fascinating. You know, you get all the way back through all these things she's done, find out she started out as a crime, you know, going to all the robberies and everything, you know, this little tiny woman. I was amazed. Just amazed. And she used to tell such funny stories about working on the news. I guess she did talk about her past more than I thought. She used to tell about a woman that she worked with on the newspaper that was always getting words confused and saying, and now I can't remember them, saying things like, I sent my, what did she call it, school. She sent her son to, I can't remember, I shouldn't have started telling the story because I can't remember any of the things. I'll have to think about it, see if I can remember them, and I'll tell you next time I see you. So she did talk somewhat.
Well, there in the office?
Mm-hmm. To me, I used to get to work before, she'd get to work first, and I'd get there before anybody else, so we'd talk while we had coffee in the morning. I guess a lot of it depends on not having other people around, like as you were saying with Cookie and being down at the Brazingtons. You know, you sort of have to be alone with people before they'll talk, unless they are the kind of person who can talk to an audience. you know, a lot of people around. No?
People I know like a little audience. They do better. I've talked to them a good bit for myself, but I find they light up. Your face there. Or Suzanne, somebody's there.
But not a general audience, you see. I mean,
That's only two or three people. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I think if there were a room full of people, they wouldn't. And see, in our office, it would have been a room full of people because we were all in the office together. So I think she responded to me as one person rather than she would have to the whole office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the reason people go to cocktail parties, I guess, to talk.
They don't talk about too much. Well, now, we had some good parties in Boston, I will say that. We had a party one time, we had some very good friends who were medical students at Tufts, and they all graduated this year and were leaving, and so we decided we'd have a last party before they left, and they liked, the two boys that were our good friends, liked steamed clams, and so we said we'll have a steamed clam party, and we'll get a whole lot of clams, and we'll all just sit on the floor and eat clams. So Jerry, one of our friends, told me that he'd be glad to go down and get the clams. He'd go pick them up. So I said, fine, because I had to work all day. So he went to pick them up, and he came at noon to the office to get the keys to the apartment so he could go and put the fresh clams in. And he came over, and he sort of got me aside because he didn't want to announce this in front of everybody in the office. And he said, Debbie, I got a really good deal on the clams. And I thought, oh, what did he get? And he bought 60 pounds of clams.
Did he?
60 pounds of live clams. You know how many that is? That fills a whole bathtub. So I said, well, Jerry, go put them in our bathtub and we'll try to find some people to eat them. So we were calling up everybody we knew to come and eat these clams. We said, look, we have 60 pounds of clams. You've got to come to dinner tonight. Come eat with us. Well, we rounded up about three more people who would come and eat clams with us. So we all came and sat on the floor and ate clams until I just thought I could not look at another clam. And we all just sort of lay back and waited about 2 hours. And then all the men in the group decided that, well, there were still two bushel baskets full of clams, and they were going to eat them. So they got up and they cooked two more huge things of clams on the stove. And at 11 o'clock at night, we're sitting there stuffing clams down, nothing. Well, who's man enough to finish these clams? And they almost finished them. They ate, I don't know how they did it, but they just, we threw away quite a lot, actually. I guess we threw away a big bucket full still. 60 pounds? I mean, even considering that the shells weigh more than the clams. So all that proves, I suppose, is that we had friends that ate a lot. But that certainly was fun. Oh dear. That was such a typical thing of Jerry, too. He was always a little over enthusiastic about everything. He was Hawaiian, and he put himself through medical school making jewelry. He had a summer job one summer at a jewelry store out in Hawaii, and he learned how to, you know, pound jewelry and solder and everything. So he just started making jewelry and selling it and helped finance his whole. We kept telling him for 2 years that he should stop being a doctor and just go make jewelry somewhere because he made such nice things. But he didn't.
And that's the way he went through medical school.
Mm-hmm. Well, not entirely, but, you know, I think he made his living money selling jewelry.
Yeah.
He couldn't possibly have made, he wouldn't have had enough time to, you know, make enough jewelry to pay his tuition, but that's it. Mm-hmm. He used to go down and get big, huge things of the wire. He made all of it out of wire. He could pound it out flat or, you know, any shape he wanted to, but he'd have a thing of silver wire about this big, you'd get it wholesale because it was so much cheaper that way.
Yeah.
It's nice jewelry.
Tell you that, huh? Well, now you could pick up a little of that too, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what the cookie said about his Frank? He could watch you use a machine and do it, sir. Well, Frank can't do that, but Cookie can.
Mm-hmm.
Cookie wishes Frank could. And someday he may do it. He's just as little as you. He's 16, 17, something. And his mind is actually not much on the machinery. That age, you know.
Yeah.
But Cookie, you know, for a long time, his mind has been on it, and he can do that.
See, all that he knows, he's taught himself by just looking.
That's right.
There's no other way that he's learned it. He's never been taught.
That's right.
He can look at a piece of machine and tell you what.
And he can take it apart and put it back.
That is just amazing. And he just knows so much about, you know, like he walked out and even before he even saw the cow, he knew what to do for it.
Yeah. Oh, I wish we'd have had that on tape. When he came in, he was so puffed up, guy. He came in to tell me. He was so puffed up, he said. For Cookie, it was really a something. He said it was a good thing I was here. He said, I knew exactly what to do. He said a vet couldn't have done it any better than and he said it any better than I did. Because I knew what to do. He stood over there and he said, I just saved the vet bill. I said, well, Cookie, we sure were lucky that you were here. He said, I knew you before I saw it was one.
Yeah.
And that's a lot, because Cookie doesn't usually come out. He'll let you intimate it. But he'll never come out and say, look at me. But he did tonight.
Yeah, he did some.
He was proud.
But he did that for
Yeah. But you know what? He started out when we first went out there. He said, I'll have this cow walking by morning. And then he kept moving it up 6 hours. And when we left, he said, well, she'll be feeling better by tomorrow night. He protects himself well, that man does. He's not leaving himself liable for anything.
Well, now look, Debbie. I don't know how to get into this. I got into this through Emerson. You see, I've worked with Emerson since I was your age. I don't know how. And all my life, I have had self-reliance, the American Scholar, the Adventist School of Dress, and Nature. One or two of them, not much of Emerson, before me. And I don't know, but it was a long time before it came to me that nothing he says is right. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather mortal palms must not be hindered with the name of goodness, but explore, inquire if it is goodness. Now you see, there's not a thing that you can substantiate about that. But it's one of the finest statements in all our culture. And stuck with him all his life. His whole inquiry was that if it be goodness. And I don't know. You see, I worked with one group after another. To start with, I didn't learn much. I thought I knew, understood it. It wasn't an inquiry with me. I had read it and studied it, and it's pretty clear, and I didn't want to pass it on, you understand? So it was a long time before I started learning much or seeing much, but eventually
I got to the point where I could see that the statement, you see, you can't examine your experience without a statement, without some interpretation. That's the term in which you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that that is true, but it's fruitful. Now, somehow or other, Cookie knows that statements are not matters of belief. Somehow or other, he knows that. See?
Mm-hmm.
And within his purpose, you see, this car will be walking in the morning. See, it's a perfect thing. It's a beautiful thing. But you see, if you're brought up on the Ten Commandments, you're all off in the wrong direction.
See how quickly you could squelch that? That
mm-hmm.
statement.
That's right.
Say you know damn well this cow won't walk in the morning.
Yeah.
And that'd be the end of it.
That'd be the end of it, of that and of cookie.
And he wouldn't talk anymore.
And he wouldn't know why. And that's the way those fellas did. They used to come out here. I'd lure one in here one way or another. And pretty soon he didn't come. And I had no idea what it was. Faith, I think, saw the light. We had these horses. We didn't know which end of the horse to approach. And this boy over here, old Johnny Sims.
Did you know Johnny?
I think I
did.
He
rode Noopy.
Right, yes. And what, didn't you get Molly?
He got
from
Molly.
Him?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well.
And with a scoundrel.
Well,
yeah.
It's not that.
No,
right.
That's not the point.
Is that, you see, he worked his head off over here, but he did it on his own terms. And Faith found how to allow him to do it on his own terms. And I had no idea how to do it. But she sort of, for the first time, she sort of got that toehold. And she didn't pay him. She gave him a little money now and then. He called her his cigarette money. Now, he collected, but he didn't collect directly. He sold the horse, you see, and that's what they work for. But there's a great deal to it, and it's not direct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the old culture, people understood that. But now, you see, we go to school so much, we don't know anything. Simply nothing. Nothing. Just enough that you can't teach anyone. You can't cut through. You can't cut through.
like in Johnny's case, I never said, "I'll see you tomorrow, Johnny,"
no,
at 4 o'clock.
No.
It was always on Johnny's turn.
Yeah.
I might be by. I'd say, okay.
Yeah.
I might get by. All right, there was nothing ever said about
nothing hard and fast.
Nothing hard and fast.
No, nothing of time.
Only one time did I say, "Johnny, I wish you'd tell me what you do to Nupi." He could have her standing still, and from a stand, and he loved Nupi. Only person I ever knew who really loved that horse.
Yeah.
And he'd have her standing still, and he'd get on her, and he'd go straight into a lope from a standstill.
Yeah.
Just like that. And I couldn't see that he did anything to us.
Yeah.
I'd say, "Johnny, teach me how to do that." He said, "I'm no teacher."
Yeah. Oh. See,
and
you see, he had that feeling. Now, where did he get it? No one told him. Yeah. And all the insight I've got, not obtainable. There's no way I can go get it.
You see, he was just down and out. He didn't have anything except that one thing that he could do, could ride that horse better than anybody could. And he wasn't going to let anybody in on the secret. That was his shining.
That was his thing.
Shining
yeah.
thing. And I couldn't, I had no right to burst that thing. I had no right to. And so he trained Nubia. Nobody else. I mean, you know, like he did.
Uh-huh.
Well, now tell us some more about that old sterile office. Let me tell you, Debbie, after you were here, I had a little class in Emerson, and this girl was in it, and she did well. And she had been out of school 7 years and worked in an office, and she was going to study art or something. And I kept putting it off and putting it off. I was going to get her in the office and lock the door and get her to tell me, because she could use the terms I used, you see, with Emerson. And I kept putting it off, and I never did do it. And I'd see her after that, afterwards. And you know, something came up that I never could get around to it. It wasn't her fault, it was mine, you see, my responsibility. I wanted to know. She knew. Thought she knew. I wanted to see what she made of that darn office. And what could be made of it, you see,
mm-hmm.
in terms of roughing it.
You know, there's something there that could be
mm-hmm.
made out of.
Yeah, people make their whole lives out of it.
Yeah.
You know, and they're reasonably happy. I don't know. I wasn't happy after a while there. I was at first for about a year actually, which is
yeah.
pretty good. I thought it was, you know, I really enjoyed it. And then I just got to be that I was just doing the same thing over and over and over again, and there wasn't anything new that I was doing each month. You know, I was writing that magazine every month, but there wasn't anything new. I mean, it was different stories, but it was sort of like you were writing the same thing over and over again. And I just sort of felt like no one was ever reading it. I would never have read it if someone had mailed it to me. It's the kind of thing that you get from your college and throw away the minute you get it. And I didn't like to feel that I was working all day long doing something that was not worthwhile at all, that people were just throwing away. I mean, that didn't make me feel very useful. So I don't know what the answer is to making an office a place where you observe things. You know, even when you go in and talk to people and interview them for stories or something, you're interviewing them about sterile things.
Right.
Who got what award at what meeting, when? I mean, who cares? I didn't care. And that was pretty hard to do after a while. I thought it was fun at first because it was fun to learn to write in that way. But after you've written 750 announcements of somebody being promoted to full professor, how many more times can you do it and still make it? Or Dr. So-and-so has just been appointed our new dean, and he has all these degrees, and isn't that wonderful? He's the only dentist in the U.S. Dental Corps who's ranked A, which means he's a fine dentist. That was the most exciting thing in that story, was that he was an A-ranked dentist. Oh, I'm terrible. Now that I'm away from it.
Do you feel you had to do it to see what it was like?
Well, it was actually, I shouldn't complain because it was a very good job as office jobs go. I even though it felt like I was doing the same thing every month, I wasn't really. And it was fun I liked the production end of it, you know, laying out the magazine. I set the type and everything myself. We had a machine that's like a typewriter, but it sets cold type. So we set all the type ourselves in the office. And that, you know, I enjoyed that. That was kind of fun. That was artsy craftsy for the month.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And we had very colorful printers. Now, we had a printer that you would have enjoyed talking to. His name was Carmen Napa.
But there you're getting on the countryside level again.
That's right. You're down to the Carmen. You're out of the office, right. And his world was utterly different than ours. The way they dress is incredible. He dressed in, he was sort of diminutive of stature, and he didn't think this was good. So he used to have lifts in his shoes, built into his shoes so he'd be a little taller, and pads in the shoulders of his suit, down the front and around the side so that he'd appear big. Oh, he's strong. And he wore the most amazing suits I have ever seen. He wore electric blue suits and lime green suits and, he had an uncle who was a tailor and used to make all these clothes for him. And they were just incredible. He never wore the same suit. He would always come in with a different suit on, and the colors would just be... I've never seen clothes like that. You don't see them in stores. He must have had them custom made for him. And he had a car that he drove that had a bar in it and a phone. This was his life was centered, I think, around his wardrobe and his car. And he was a nice Italian boy, and he lived at home with his mother and his two older brothers. Carmen must be 35, and they all live at home with mother until this winter. Carmen finally got an apartment of his own at 35, and he went to live there, but it was around the corner from his mother's, and he got up every morning and went to his mother's for breakfast. And, once, I never talked to him about his family life at all, except that one Thanksgiving he was talking about the food that they ate, because we had just cooked, I think it was the first Thanksgiving I was up there, and we cooked a turkey, and he was in the office after Thanksgiving, and I was commenting on the fact that I had never cooked a turkey before, and we cooked Thanksgiving dinner. And he started describing the Thanksgiving meal that Italian families have. Well, they start out with lasagna and spaghetti. That's the appetizer. And then they go from that, through the antipastos and the every other manicotti and every possible conceivable pasta dish before they get to the turkey and the dressing and the six pies. And he said, I always gain a lot of weight during Thanksgiving. And I thought, how do you get up from the table? I mean, if I had lasagna for an appetizer, I couldn't even look at a turkey. And how he needs shoulder pads, I don't know, with what his mother must feed him. And it runs printers. The wild dressing runs with all the printers we dealt with in Boston. Every single one dressed like that. We had another printer. One of the men that I worked with used almost exclusively, and he was sort of stuck on blue and pink. And he used to wear pink shirts with flowers on them. And he had the most baby face. Big, cheerful, round face. He looked like he was about 15 years old. And come in wearing these incredible clothes. I don't know what it is. Maybe it just happened that the printers we knew were like that. But I should get to know some in Gainesville and see how they dress.
I never heard of anything like that.
Just amazing.
Maybe it's the Italian side.
Well, this other one was not Italian. It might be that it'd be Italian, because they certainly, Boston is very...
Well, now, I have never had, I've lived in cities, but I've never been urban, It was just a sojourn. I didn't belong there. I lived, ain't going to school and work and all. Liking that urban experience, and all the youngsters here are urban, everybody's urban now, but if I work with Mark Twain, I do it as something they can use to get into their own culture. I don't want another Wild West, just
for them to have something to talk about. And I've had a little luck at that. I can work out some of the, you know, help them work out some of the, I can help them get into it. But one thing, they can't read Mark Twain. They think of it as exaggeration. And I read them that little piece from Canadian humorist who wrote a little nice little book on Mark Twain. And he says he did have those tricks of the old 19th century humor, some of them, but he outgrew them. And to think of Twain as a funny man, you see, just using those tricks, would be to miss him. He says all of his humor is in his point of view. He says no one saw Kaiser until Mark Twain had lunch with him. And it's his point of view. All right. Once you look at the point of view, then you transfer that to the stories, and you look at it and see what's fresh, and what the direction is, and what his interpretation of the experience is. And you take it seriously. That's not quite the right word, but, you know, but it's not human anymore. It's a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a small adjustment, but it's black and white. To go from Mark Twain as a funny man and good-natured, who exaggerates, to a man whose perceptions have such a genius, and his interpretations, you see, open up the experience, but he never makes a statement of what the interpretation is. It's all in the direction of the experience. And you see, now, as academic as we are, I am. You see, I make one statement right after another and just pound it hard, you see. I make such strong statements you can't see the experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. Leacock, Stephen Leacock, has that beautiful little thing about Mark Twain. Can't see him as a humorist with all those 19th century tricks of humor. It's an angle of vision. It's a point of view. And then you, if those words don't mean anything to you, you've got to keep working it until his statement, his abstraction, means something to
mm-hmm.
you. And to me, it would be his perception or his interpretation of what he sees. That's his angle of vision. And that takes it out of the realm of art or criticism into something that's that you can use.
I was just thinking when Debbie was talking about the premise coming, she probably hadn't really thought about him. But once you set up the structure where she could, you can look at him,
yeah,
he'll become alive.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, you have to talk. You have to see him like this.
Right.
Yeah.
It's almost like repeating a conversation, looking back at him again,
yeah.
Or somebody.
Or looking back at Marion and realizing how much I did know about her life and didn't realize I did. Yeah.
But somebody has to be interested,
mm-hmm.
and give you the chance and create the structure for you to talk and you to see.
Right.
So
that's
how
I.
You can't do it by yourself.
No.
You simply can't do it by yourself. What little I've picked up, I'm sort of like Ahab in persistence, you see. I have such a focus to just destroy people. But I don't have much light along with it, you see. So that I have seen through just one person's eyes right after another.
Mm-hmm.
even after all that, you see, I still see so little. So it's one man can't do it. One person can't do it.
You almost have to be monastic. You see, I've seen guys, your father does, and all the scholars do, sit in a little cell, you know, month after year, after year, after year, you know. And this is actually the same thing. See, he focuses so that he can make this possible.
Yeah, it helps. I mean, it keeps you doing, but it takes a lot of people to see, just to see. See, I'd read Mark Twain for years and years and years before I even knew what he's done in the Mexican Plug Horse. And you see, Bud Guthrie wrote that novel back in the 40s that I knew him. And said the same thing, but I didn't realize just what he was saying. You can't see that in Mark Twain because our response to things is altogether different. You see, I go down to J.M. Field and buy some shoes and bring them back, and I find that they're old plastic things and the soles won't stay on, and I cuss. I don't say like Mark Twain, you see, was great, but it was such a light touch that I've been taking.
Yeah.
You see, I'm paralyzed. All my faculties are paralyzed.
That's right.
His were alive. Isn't that amazing?
His were alive. And you see, could be alive.
Yeah. And no one talked to him. The thing of it is, Cookie got it in West Virginia. He stayed there long enough as an adult to absorb some of that old culture, that way of life. You see, if you go to school, it cuts you off from it. And if you leave when you're young, a young person can't project. They may plow a horse, but they don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back, you see, as an adult. And what he says about that, you see, is a mature response to. And that's the reason I can listen to him. I left too young. And he came back and finished it out. I have roots there, but I can't reproduce it. And he can. It's not in me. I had too much school. We talk about, say, Sister Frances. She has that gift. And she barely got through school. She just wasn't. Got through at the time when you could get through by sitting on the professor's knee. What did we used to say?
That's the way she got through college, didn't
just on. Going in and talking to the professor.
She was cute, you know.
She was cute. And at that time, she was,
I
don't know how
that.
Much longer that lasted, but it lasted a little while after Frances did. But that's the way she got through school. And it was her salvation.
That's the way she does.
That's the way we talk about it.
And
you see, and she has those same. She can recapture all those Mexican plug horses from the very beginning, right along.
And not conscious of, you know.
And not conscious of what she's doing.
Oh no. But she does it with such a merry way, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, she's really sort of intolerant of me and Guy, you know, that we have to.
Oh yeah,
we
have to do it the hard way.
Do it the hard way. It seems so simple. It's like my daddy, you know. He always knew which way the wind was blowing. He thought you were just.
Now this is the end of Channel 1 over. The end of Channel 1 over, and this is Debbie's side, and her response to Cookie and her understanding of him. The Channel 1 over. The end of Channel 1 over, the Wednesday night after supper, the 11th of August, 1971. The end of Channel 1 over. This is Debbie's side. And her response to Cookie, this Wednesday night after supper, the 11th of August, 1971. Channel 1 over. And the end of visit with Debbie and Cookie, this Wednesday night, the 11th of August, 1971. The 11th of August, 1971. Channel 1 over. And this is Debbie's side, her response to Cookie, this 11th of August, Wednesday night, 1971, Channel 1 over. And that's the end of the visit with Cookie and Debbie, this Wednesday night after supper.